Part 11. Reordering. Welcome back. So, in part 10, you close the deal. First order placed, factory confirmed, the whole nervous machinery of that first transaction set in motion. And I said something at the end about the second order being a completely different game. Here we are. Nobody makes a documentary about the second order. The first order has drama, the hustle, the negotiation, the sample that arrives late, the moment you finally commit. The second order looks routine, feels routine, is absolutely not routine. Here's the quiet truth about reordering. The first order is almost always your best negotiated one. And not because you were particularly clever, because both sides wanted the deal. The supplier was trying to win you. You were comparing options. That mutual need creates real negotiating pressure. From the second order on, that pressure evaporates. You're comfortable, they're familiar. And comfortable is exactly when people stop asking questions, which is exactly when things get expensive. Let's start with price, because this is the number one place margins get quietly eaten alive. A very common mistake, and I mean very common, is assuming that a price negotiated once holds permanently. It does not. In Chinese business culture, a price is a condition. It applies to this order under these circumstances at this moment. Raw materials fluctuate, exchange rates move, production capacity shifts, the supplier recalculates every order. The question is whether you do the same. Before every reorder, get current data on the table. What are relevant raw materials costing right now? How is the exchange rate trending? Has the supplier's order book gotten tighter? Negotiating with data is negotiating from strength. Hitting reorder without checking is agreeing to whatever the supplier considers a reasonable markup. And spoiler, their idea of reasonable and yours may not be identical. Now here's the move that most people only think big companies can make. Joint annual planning. Stay with me because this works with as few as 2 or 3 orders a year. You share your estimated annual volume with the supplier, broken down by quarter, rough order dates. In return, you lock in price ranges, payment terms, lead times. The supplier gets planning certainty. They can buy materials at better rates, reserve production capacity. You get price stability and preferred treatment when the factory is slammed. And the plan doesn't have to be perfect. Plus or minus 20% variance is fine. What matters is the signal. This customer thinks long term. They are not a one-time buyer. That signal alone changes your negotiating position more than most people expect. A supplier who sees you as a long-term partner optimizes the relationship. A supplier who sees you as a purchase order optimizes their margin. Choose which one you want to be. Same logic on volume discounts. Most importers negotiate volume discounts at the first order and then forget the conversation ever happened. The real volume discounts don't come from individual orders. They come from cumulative annual volume. Signaling 10,000 units spread across a year puts you in a completely different position than someone ordering 3,000 units 3 separate times. Use the total annual volume as your negotiating base, even if delivery happens in tranches, and get the tiered pricing in writing. Verbal commitments in Chinese business practice have a shorter shelf life than European importers tend to expect, sometimes a surprisingly short one. So the takeaway for this chapter, reorders are not autopilot. Every cycle is a negotiation. Price should be checked, not assumed. Annual planning is available to anyone willing to commit to a number, even a rough one. The margin you protect here compounds over every order you ever place. The margin you give away compounds too. Just in the wrong direction. Chapter 49. The Quiet Drift. Why the second batch is where quality slips. Alright, this one is a chapter I almost wish I didn't have to write. Because it describes something that happens so gradually, you don't notice it until it's done. Quality erosion on reorders. Here's the mechanism. On the first order, the supplier delivers the best possible quality because they want to win you. The sample was perfect. The first batch was clean. You're satisfied. You reorder. The relationship feels solid. And starting with the second order, a quiet optimization process begins on the supplier side. Not malicious, systematic. The wall thickness of a plastic housing gets reduced by 0.2 millimeter. A paint gets mixed with 1% less pigment. A seam gets sewn with fewer stitches per centimeter. Each individual change, barely perceptible. In aggregate, after 3 or 4 reorders, you end up with a product that bears little resemblance to what you originally approved. And the first time you find out is usually when the customer reviews start using the word flimsy. Never a fun morning, that one. The goal on the supplier side isn't to cheat you. It's to find out what quality level you'll still accept in order to improve their own margin. It's entirely rational from their position, which means the only defense is systematic, consistent QC on every single order. Not every other order. Not when you have a feeling something's off. Every order. And here's where the psychology gets tricky. The supplier will push back. Every time. The three greatest hits. The quality is the same as last time. We use the same materials and the same process. An inspection isn't necessary. We know each other now. All three statements are at best well-intentioned. Because even if the supplier sincerely believes nothing has changed, production variables shift constantly. Different raw material batches, different operators at the machine, different temperatures in the hall. The only reliable answer to whether quality is right is a professional inspection. Not reassurance, an inspection. The pre-shipment inspection, the PSI, is a standard process for every reorder. It happens before the goods leave the factory and it checks against your documented specifications. Not against what the supplier considers normal. 3 levels. Physical product quality, dimensions, weight, wall thickness, color, workmanship. Packaging and labeling, correct labels, barcodes, warning symbols, pack density. And transport safety of master cartons, usually through drop tests. Which sounds dramatic until you remember the alternative is finding out your cartons collapse halfway through a European distribution center. And the inspection needs to be independent. Leaving it entirely to the supplier is like asking a student to grade their own exam. The results are predictably optimistic. Third-party inspection through established services costs somewhere between $250 and $400 per inspection, depending on product complexity. That is a fraction of what a defective batch costs once it's already sitting in your warehouse. One practical thing that doesn't get enough attention. Starting with your very first order, store a physical reference sample alongside your documented quality standard, a golden sample. Every subsequent order gets checked against that, not against the most recent shipment. Because if you only compare against the previous batch, you might be comparing an already degraded product against an even more degraded one. The baseline drifts, and so does your standard. The golden sample is your anchor. Use it. The book goes deep on the full inspection framework, the AQL tables, what to check at each production phase, how to write a checkable specification. Here, the principle is the one to lock in. QC on reorders is not a precaution. It is the operational core of any supplier relationship that actually holds. The factories that have never had a quality problem are the ones whose customers check every time. Correlation, not coincidence.
Chapter 50. Becoming a priority customer. Relationship and contract terms on reorders. The first order is a transaction. The second order is the beginning of a relationship. European importers systematically underestimate that difference. And they pay for the underestimation in exactly the moments when having a good relationship would have fixed the problem in 24 hours. In Chinese business culture, the concept of guanxi has an operational meaning that goes beyond what most Western importers expect. It's not friendship in the personal sense. It's a web of mutual trust, obligation, and long-term orientation. And it matters because a supplier who sees you as a priority partner doesn't just treat you better. They tell you first when there's a problem. They hold capacity for you when the factory is slammed. They flag a material issue before it becomes your production issue. A supplier who sees you as a purchase order does none of those things. So what does relationship building actually look like? Not a gift, not a dinner. It starts with reliability and communication. Inform the supplier early about planned orders. Give feedback on the last shipment, even when it's positive. Respond to messages. Pay on time or a little early. I know, groundbreaking. And yet it separates a remarkable number of importers from their competitors, because most people don't bother with any of it once the first order clears. Starting with the second or third order, visit the factory whenever possible. Not as an inspection, as a gesture of presence. Physical presence in Chinese business culture is a powerful signal. Showing up in person says, this relationship matters enough to me to travel for. That signal has real commercial value. It's not soft, it's strategic. and build a direct line to production management. The sales rep is the gatekeeper for new business, not the lever for consistent quality. A direct WeChat contact to production management means quality problems get raised faster and resolved at the level where actual decisions get made. In China, relevant business communication runs almost entirely through WeChat, not email. Email is where things go to wait. Now, contracts on reorders. A very common pattern is to take the same purchase order from the first order, update the quantity, and hit send. Convenient and quietly risky. Every reorder should be a standalone document reflecting current terms, current specifications, and current agreements. Because three things will have changed since the first order: what you know about the product's weaknesses, what you know about the supplier's tendencies, and what the market requires of the product. The specification sheet is a living document, not a finished one. After the first delivery, you have real-world data. What defects appeared? Where was a tolerance too loose? Which specification was worded too vaguely and got interpreted wrong? Those findings have to feed into the specification for the reorder. Tighten the tolerances that prove problematic. Define measurement procedures where inspection was only visual before. Specify material requirements more precisely where the supplier found and used ambiguity. A specification that is identical after three orders to the one you wrote at the start was either perfect from day one or has never been updated. In practice, it's almost always the latter. And payment terms. The standard first order split, 30% deposit, 70% before shipment, makes sense when the relationship is new and the risk is high. From the second or third order onward, those terms should be renegotiated. Reduce the deposit. Pay part of the balance only after passing the PSI. Pay the balance against presentation of the original bill of lading, the B/L, which only gets issued after the vessel departs. The manufacturer will push for timely payment. They effectively have no leverage. The ship is not turning around over an outstanding invoice. Every shift in payment timing in your favor reduces financial risk and improves cash flow. But do not abuse it. Timely payment on agreed terms is the strongest proof of trust in a Chinese business relationship. Becoming unreliable with payments destroys Guanxi faster than almost any other misstep. And Guanxi, once gone, takes a very long time to rebuild.
Chapter 51. Lead times, logistics, and the danger of a single supplier. Here's a belief that quietly wrecks reorder timelines more than anything else. The second order will be faster because they already know the product. Logical, usually wrong. Here's what actually disappears from the timeline on a reorder: the development phase, the sampling, the back and forth on specifications. That's real time saved. What doesn't disappear? Materials procurement, tooling preparation, production scheduling. Those lead times remain largely the same. And in practice, reorders are sometimes slower than first orders because the supplier has prioritized other work in the meantime. A factory doesn't hold capacity for you out of loyalty. They hold it for the customers who planned ahead. The rest wait. Peak season at Chinese factories runs September through December. Production timelines in those months can stretch by 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes more. And the single biggest predictable risk factor in any reorder calendar is Chinese New Year, CNY. Production slows 2 to 3 weeks before the holiday. It takes another 1 to 2 weeks after the holiday before the full workforce is back in production once normally. On top of that, many workers change employers after Chinese New Year. New people on the line means quality fluctuations during onboarding. The first batch after CNY is almost always the most interesting one to inspect. Not in a good way. Operational rule: any reorder needed in Q1 must be placed no later than November of the prior year. Build the CNY window explicitly into your annual planning conversation with the supplier. It is not a surprise that happens once in a while. It happens every year on roughly the same schedule. Plan for it, and it's a detail. Don't plan for it, and it's a crisis. Now, dependency. With every reorder, your dependency on the supplier deepens. At first, this is natural and efficient. You know each other, processes are established, communication flows. The problem starts when the supplier recognizes the dependency and begins to leverage it. A supplier who knows you have no alternative can push on price, stretch lead times, or let quality standards drift a little further, confident you'll absorb it rather than risk the disruption of switching. The counter is dual sourcing, and I don't mean constantly running two suppliers in parallel. That adds complexity most operations don't need. I mean, once order volume reaches a meaningful level, qualify a second supplier. Not necessarily for live production.
for existence, a tested, approved sample from an alternative supplier, a calculated cost structure, clear specifications ready to hand over. The mere existence of a qualified alternative changes your negotiating position. And in the event of a real problem, a quality collapse, a delivery failure, a price explosion, you're not scrambling to find someone new while stock runs out. You're making a phone call. That's a very different conversation to be having. And one more thing on dependency, because this is a trap that only reveals itself at exactly the worst moment. Tooling, molds. If you paid for production tooling or injection molds, you legally own them. In practice, they sit at the factory, which means the supplier physically controls your asset. By the third reorder at the latest, the contract should clearly establish tooling is the importer's property. It must be handed over on request or transferred to an alternative supplier. And here's the detail most people don't ask about. Shot count. An injection mold has a finite lifespan, from roughly 100,000 cycles for a simple aluminum mold to several million for hardened steel. A mold with 800,000 shots on it is considerably closer to end of life than one with 50,000, even if both look fine externally. An importer who doesn't know the shot count may take possession of tooling at a supplier switch that can only produce a few thousand more units, which is a discovery that tends to arrive at a very inconvenient time. Also establish whether the manufacturer is using your mold for other customers. It happens. Without an exclusivity clause, your mold may formally belong to you while accumulating shots for someone else's product. The contract should address documentation of the shot count, exclusivity of use, and who bears the costs for maintenance and eventual replacement. This is all in the book in detail. Here just hold the principle. What you paid for should be provably yours and usable when you need it.
Chapter 52. Documentation, compliance, and the six classic traps. Last chapter of the reordering section. And I want to do two things here. Cover the compliance side that most people treat as an afterthought, and then run through the six mistakes that show up on reorders more reliably than almost anything else in this whole business. Let's start with compliance, because this is the one with no margin for optimism. Every reorder needs a brief compliance check. Have any relevant standards changed since the last order? Are there new requirements for labeling, packaging, or documentation? Does the technical file need to be updated? Three questions, roughly 10 minutes. Potentially existential problems avoided. In the European market, the regulatory environment moves faster than most importers expect. The CE directives, reach restrictions, ROS limits, and the tightened GPSR requirements that came into force in 2024 all affect what a compliant product looks like. A product that was fully compliant 12 months ago may not be compliant on the reorder today, without a single thing about the product itself having changed, simply because the regulation changed. And the marketplace or customs finding out before you do is never the preferred order of events. Understated, but accurate. For the US market, parallel requirements apply. FCC rules for wireless technologies, CPSC regulations for consumer goods, Prop 65 in California for chemical substances, TSCA provisions, and FDA frameworks for cosmetics, food, and medical devices. The specific regulatory machinery varies by product category, and the book works through it in full. Here the principle is simple. Build a compliance check into your reorder process as a fixed step. Not optional, fixed. Alright, the six traps. These do not come from ignorance. They come from complacency. The system worked last time, so it'll work again. That assumption is the source of most problems in this whole part of the business. Trap 1. Not renegotiating the price. Result? Gradual margin erosion over multiple order cycles. The supplier adjusts their pricing in line with rising costs. The importer doesn't notice because they didn't ask. Over three or four orders, a margin that looked solid quietly becomes a margin that requires a spreadsheet and some optimism to defend. Trap 2. Reducing or skipping QC. Result? The product deteriorates gradually. By the time the end customer notices and the reviews start changing, the reputational damage is already done. And reversing a reputation trend is considerably harder than preventing one. The inspection exists precisely because you cannot assume nothing changed.
Trap 3. No updated specification. Result: a widening gap between what you expect and what the supplier delivers. Without the current specification, you have no solid basis for a complaint. You can be right, and without documentation, being right doesn't help you much.
Trap 4. Communicating only through the sales rep. Result: problems get filtered, delayed, or downplayed. The importer hears about quality or delivery issues only when it's too late to respond cheaply. The sales rep's job is to close deals. Quality consistency is somebody else's job. That somebody else needs to be reachable. Trap 5. No backup supplier. Result: complete dependency on a single production partner. If that partner has a problem, raises prices aggressively, or simply decides you are less interesting than their new customer, you have no alternative. And building one from scratch while stock runs out is exactly as stressful as it sounds. Trap 6. Not updating compliance. Result: a product that was compliant on the first order may not be on the third. And finding that out from customs or a marketplace suspension rather than your own review is a very expensive way to get the information. It also tends to arrive during the busiest part of the quarter. Timing has a sense of humor. So, here's the one line I want to leave you with for the whole of part 11. Reorders are not the operational part of importing. They are a distinct strategic process with their own risks, their own negotiation rules, and their own quality traps. Importers who treat the second order with the same rigor as the first protect their margin, stabilize their quality, and build a supplier relationship that actually holds. Those who switch to cruise control after the first order aren't building a business. They're building a dependency. And dependency in the import business is the surest path to losing control of your own product. If you want the full framework, the negotiation tactics chapter by chapter, the inspection protocols, the specification update process, the dual sourcing decision criteria, the tooling contract language, it's all in the book. Every chapter in this section has operational depth the overview can only point to. The overview shows you the shape of the problem. The book shows you what to do about it. Now, you've built the foundation. You've sourced, sampled, shipped, and now you know how to repeat it without giving back what you earned. Which brings us to the question that naturally follows all of that. What happens when it works? When one product is running, reorders are solid, the system is real, what do you do with it? How do you turn a working product into a working business? How do you build a second product without breaking the first? How do you go from importer to operator, from someone running an order to someone running an organization? That's part 12, scaling and lifecycle. Turning what you've built into something that actually runs without you being personally responsible for every container. Which, frankly, is the whole point. See you in part 12.